We present the third chapter in our series, Great Balls of Fire, a popular music essay on the 50s, presented by Pete Myers. And the year under review,
1952.
Goodness gracious, Great Balls of Fire!
Best things first, and he was 35 when he cut this.
G is great after being out late, walking my baby back home. Arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home. We go long harmonizing a song, or I'm reciting a poem. Hours go by and they give me the eye, walking my baby back home. We stop for a while, she gives me a smile, snuggles her head on my chest. We starting to pet, and that's when I get her talcum all over my vest. After I kinda straighten my tie, she has to borrow my comb. One kiss, then I continue again, walking my baby back home. The dark, so I have to park outside of her door till it's light. She says if I try to kiss her, she'll cry. I dry her tears all through the night, hand in hand to a barbecue stand. Right from her doorway we roam. Eats and then it's a pleasure again, walking my baby, talking my baby, loving my baby. I don't mean maybe, walking my baby back home.
A classic that had class from beginning to end. Nat King Cole's Walking My Baby Back Home. In 1952, Cole was the most famous of what were known as the crossover artists. Black performers who were extremely popular with white audiences and record buyers. People like Lena Horne, Billy Eckstine, Ella and Louie, and Sarah Vaughan. All of them had distinctive voices, but under the control of the major recording companies, their output was totally geared for white consumption. So much so, you couldn't tell the difference between chalk and chitlins. An example. Well, that was the hit version by a lady who used to sing with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra in the 40s. She recorded for Company A. Company B decided to cover the same song, different singer. And the end result? In the shrimp boat up ahead, you had Miss White, Joe Stafford, following in the boat behind, Miss Black, Sarah Vaughan. Now, personally, I find it repulsive to talk in terms of race, but the world of 1952 was extremely racially divided, particularly in the United States, where even music was segregated. Very little of this division was known to us in Europe, or that there existed a wealth of material marketed by little independent record companies for blacks only. It was known then as race music, and out of this reservoir would come rhythm and blues, soul, and rock and roll.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around 10 o'clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, ho. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight.
The historic recording that officially launched the rock era in 1955, Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock. But it was not the first rock and roll song. That Agree or Disagree was cut in 1951 in Memphis, Tennessee, at a legendary little studio where Elvis Presley would record his first tracks. The Sun Recording Studio, run by Sam Phillips, a far-sighted white southerner who had a gift for recognizing and recording talent, black and white, that others would ignore. In March 1951, the studio got its first R&B number one, a rhythm and blues then being the market exclusively for black record buyers, with a recording that historians now acknowledge as the very first rock record. I ended last week's program with it, but then you didn't know that the band belonged to a 19-year-old named Ike Turner. He's on piano. Jackie Brenston, the sax player, did the vocal, and the song was about a popular car at the time known as the Rocket 8-8.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along. Smart and designed, black convertible top, and the gals don't mind. Sporting with me, riding all around town for joy. Blow your horn, Raymond, blow! In my rocket and don't be late, baby, we're pulling out about 8:30. Going round the corner and get a bill. Everybody in my car's gonna take a little nip. Move on out, oozing and cruising along.
But we had to wait 3 years before the flame burned bright. The record that deserves a place in the Rock Hall of Fame, Rocket 88. In fact, in this little snippet of gossip will illustrate its influence, Bill Haley was actually in the studio when that record was cut in 1951. He also recorded it, but it didn't get anywhere. But it makes it the first rock recording by a white musician. Now, this racial division of music deprived us of some marvelous performers whose unique energy, music, and talent would only truly be recognized by whites in the 60s.
They called me the howling bottle of bubble. And you found me howling at your door. They called me the howling wolf, baby. Didn't you know you found me howling at your door?
The Sandpiper Pipes of the Mississippi Man, Howlin' Wolf.
Hey, Mr. Cupid, step into my life. I met a fine cat and I've just got to be his wife. Cupid, don't let me down this morning. Things will be okay. If you'll just help me get this fine mellow man today.
The voice of little Esther. Little because she was just 13 years old when she was singing with the Johnny Otis outfit. Later she would find fame as Esther Phillips. And while we were peddling away in shrimp boats, the great Otis was peddling this electric rhythm. And frankly, if it wasn't for racism, we would have been into the sound, into the rock era, long before it actually happened. But in the year that America tested its first hydrogen bomb...
Dwight D. Eisenhower was elected president of the USA.
Kwame Nkrumah becomes the first African prime minister.
The Mau Mau rise up in Kenya.
George VI dies and Elizabeth is queen.
When the Diary of Anne Frank is published.
Helsinki hosts the Olympic Games.
And the war in Korea drags on.
When all of this is happening, no one could escape Alfred Cheney.
1952.
His career was at its peak in 52. Alfred Cheney, also known as Al Martino. Here in My Heart was the first record to top an official hit parade in Europe. You see, the concept of a hit parade had been going in the States since 1940 with the Billboard list. But in 52, an English pop paper, the New Musical Express, published a list of the top 15 best-selling records in Britain, and Martino was the first on that list. Here in Holland, the chart was established in 58, but only really took off as late as 1964. Meantime, things were changing in Europe, and Britain was beginning to challenge America's dominance in popular music. Record buyers were turning to homegrown talent, and because British records were easier to distribute in Europe, a lot of this music began making inroads on the mainland, particularly Holland and the Scandinavian countries. None of the recordings were particularly exciting, but they were different in style from the music coming from the States. The unforgettable cascading strings of the Mantovani Orchestra. Born in Venice, Mantovani moved to Britain in 1921 and created a sound that sold millions of his records in Europe and America. And in 1952, one of the most enduring and admired performers of the century finally became the first British singer to top the British charts. And she did it with this. Forces sweetheart, Vera Lynn. Sitting at what she called her other piano, this honky-tonk lady deserves a special place in Britain's pop history. Winifred Atwell came from Trinidad and was the first black Briton to top the charts in Europe. A big lady with a dazzling smile, she died in Australia in 1983. Now, in my book, she's something of a pioneer, as she was the first of her race to make the major breakthrough in European pop and open the way for many of the black Britons who would follow her lead. And this was her big hit of the year, the black and white rag. The now familiar drum roll and fanfare that said the product came from that major Hollywood studio, 20th Century Fox. The version you just heard was actually heard for the first time in 1952, when audiences were deserting film theaters for the comfort of an armchair and television. Hollywood answered back by using its technology to extend the cinema screen.
Cinerama,
which was spectacular but too expensive for theaters to convert to. Then from the Fox studios came a system that really caught on.
CinemaScope.
And the first film in this new widescreen process was a biblical epic called The Robe. The Robe proved to be such potent box office that other studios began using the CinemaScope process. In 52, 3D was also introduced, but the gimmick didn't last as audiences had to wear special glasses to get the effect. Cinerama and CinemaScope were not only visual advancements in cinema, they also introduced a new dimension in sound that the recording industry only latched onto 4 years later and which revolutionized our listening taste. The key words, stereophonic sound.
And
And yet, in spite of all this technological wonder, the most memorable film moment of the year took place on a regular screen in an MGM musical that to this day is regarded as the best ever made, certainly the most popular. And in it, the incomparable Gene Kelly opened his umbrella and sang the song that became his trademark.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane with a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain. Dancing in the rain. I'm happy again. I'm singing and dancing in. Singing in the rain.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, wait long.
The title song from the movie that has since been elevated to the status of classic, Stanley Kramer's High Noon, the Western in which an aging Gary Cooper gave one of his best performances and rightly picked up an Academy Award. The song also won an Oscar and was sung in the movie by singing cowboy Tex Ritter. It did fairly well in the charts, but not as well as the cover version by the singer who was establishing himself as the dominant voice of the pre-rock years, Frankie Lane.
Not forsake me, oh my darling. You made that promise as a bride. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Although you're grieving, don't think of leaving. Now that I need you by my side, wait long,
wait long,
wait long,
wait long. High Noon was also the film in which a young, exquisitely beautiful actress from Philadelphia made her debut as Cooper's young wife.
We were on the right side, but that didn't help them any when the shooting started. My brother was 19. I watched him die.
The serene and stately Grace Kelly, destined to become the mistress of Monaco. And Lauren Bacall, Mrs. Humphrey Bogart, was handing out the first of three awards to Norma Jean Baker.
I'd like to present to you the Look Achievement Award as the most outstanding feminine newcomer of 1952.
Thank you, Lauren.
And as best young box office personality, Miss Marilyn Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols.
Marilyn Monroe, the moviegoers of America, voted you the most popular actress of the year. My congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Sims.
The deedly 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 dum. Poop poopy doop.
In October 1952, London saw the world premiere of Charlie Chaplin's film Limelight. In the States, where he had worked and lived for 40 years, he was accused of being a communist sympathizer and hounded by the FBI and the McCarthy witch hunt. In disgust, Chaplin left America and settled in Switzerland. But time has a way of healing all wounds. And in 1971, the great clown returned to America, where he was feted and honored for his genius. Chaplin not only wrote and directed his films, he also composed the music. And for Limelight, he found this poignant melody. The theme from Chaplin's Limelight that went round the world. A world that was finally shedding its post-war image and evolving a style that gave the 50s character. In popular music, style was the key word. And I'll conclude with a singer who had the distinction of being the only American Indian to make the number one spot in Europe and the States. In my opinion, she was one of the most thrilling voices of the 50s. And in 52, the Wheel of Fortune was really spinning for K-Star.
While the wheel is spinning, 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 I'll not dream of winning fortune or fame. While the wheel is turning, 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 I'll be yearning, yearning. Oh, love's precious flame, oh, wheel.
And that was the third program in a 9-part series, written and produced by Pete Myers. Great Balls of Fire is a Radio Netherlands presentation.